Good morning, and thank you for joining me on The Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Wednesday, January 11th, 2023. And you know, the number one question that we've gotten for years, literally for years, whether it's on an article, a blog, a podcast, a video, on pretty much anything, liberty, natural rights, the Constitution, founding principles, normally the number one most frequently asked question that we get is some version of, okay, yeah, great, but what do we do about that? What do we do about it? That's great information, but what do we do about it? So on this episode, for at least the 10th time, and it's definitely not enough in the face of government-run schools that absolutely never teach this kind of stuff, I'm going to go through the strategy and advice of some leading founders and old revolutionaries on how to keep the government in check when government refuses to respect the Constitution and liberty, which is 24/7, 365, every single day of the year. I've got insight from people like Madison and Jefferson and Adams and Dickinson and maybe a little Hancock and a few others. But first of all, before getting to that, a quick hello and a huge thank you. Thank you so much for being here, whether this is your first episode or you've been here for every single one since day one. And while we allow people another couple of minutes, maybe a minute or so, to get notifications on the mainstream platform so you can join us in the live stream, I want to say hi to everyone out in the live chat. Kirk Morrison, good to see you. Hope you're doing well. Kirk had mentioned that, just a quick side note, I've struggled with back issues for about 3.5 years. And where things, if anybody has trouble like I do, I know Kirk said you were in the comments the other day, you had trouble with this. But if anybody has any troubles and they want to try something different, there's a great book by a guy named Stuart McGill that I read that really gave me a lot of insight on how to move things forward. That's an interesting side note. Anyways, Dixie Strong and Bama, Tyler B., Clay Kent, M. Gabriel, Liberty Gal, Irwin Haverneck in Omaha, Cheriton Farmer, Alan Hughes, Roy Rogers, King Nobody, that's a good one, in Central Colorado, Lawrence Smith, Senator DT, Too Tall, and everyone else, thank you for being here. I should mention that if you want to follow along with the original source documents I'm going to be citing in this episode, articles and other things like that, you have to follow us over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. It's all spelled out, 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. Now, first of all, before getting into the advice of what should be done, I want to point out that what most people do when they want to stop the federal government from doing things that they shouldn't be doing, they generally take one of three approaches, or maybe all three, and they totally ignore the stuff that I'm going to cover after that. First, maybe they'll march on Washington, D.C. and demand that the people in power stop doing the things they weren't supposed to be doing in the first place. You know that stuff that you've been doing? Stop. We'll make you stop. And if they don't follow after number one, maybe they'll try to get some new bums. They'll try to find some new bums to replace the old bums that refuse to follow the rules that were given to them in the Constitution, in the hopes that those new bums, if you can even get them in there, will just give up all the power that's being handed to them on a silver platter. And when that doesn't work either, or in most cases it doesn't, then they'll go to the federal courts in the hopes that some politically connected federal lawyers, lawyers as federal judges, I guess, will somehow limit federal power. In essence, all of these people, all of these strategies are people asking the federal government to limit its own power. And even if this seems like any or all of them work once in a while, every few years, every few decades, here and there, it's just a scam. It's a trick. This is not a people living in a land of the free. It's really a population on its knees begging for permission. And we were warned over and over and over how that would play out. And we shouldn't be surprised that if you take these types of approaches for generations upon generations, which is exactly what's happened here, you're going to end up living under the largest government in history at some point in time. This is exactly what Patrick Henry warned us would happen in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, his speech of June 5th, 1788, second day, I think, of the convention. He said, "Show me that age and country where the rights and liberties of the people were placed on the sole chance of their rulers being good men without a consequent loss of liberty." Show me that time, any time through history, Patrick Henry challenged people, that when you just trust the fate of your liberty to the people in power doing the right thing, or just say, follow these rules, and then they do what they're supposed to do, which is follow the rules, you're always going to lose liberty. He said, "I say that the loss of that dearest privilege has ever followed with absolute certainty every such mad attempt. So covering the political spectrum in the early days of the Republic, at the time of the ratification, through the Revolution and things like that, I've got three founders that basically asked the essential question that we're trying to answer here today. What do we do when government goes beyond its limits? Here's Thomas Jefferson. You may be familiar with him. His draft, or we can call it the fair copy. Of course, I will link to this in the show notes, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/PathToLiberty. I publish a blog post for each episode about 1 to 2 hours after the live stream is done. So if you're watching live and you want to find where these links are, it'll be a couple hours. But I publish a blog post there. There's a show link section, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/PathToLiberty. So Thomas Jefferson, in response to the hated Alien and Sedition Acts, as sitting vice president, he was secretly drafting resolutions to be passed, introduced, and then passed in Kentucky. A version of this was passed, but here's how Jefferson put it. Because he's asking, well, what do you do when government is doing things that you don't like? There's two versions for Jefferson. One, you don't like the policy that's within the bounds of the Constitution. How do you deal with it then? And then two, what about when you see it going beyond the Constitution? And for us, really, we have to think about the latter all the time, because that's really what's happening all the time. Jefferson said, in cases of an abuse of the delegated power, so this is when they're doing bad policy within the delegated powers. In cases of an abuse of the delegated powers, the members of the general government being chosen by the people, a change by the people would be the constitutional remedy. That's the Jeffersonian flair for choose new bums when you just don't like the policies that they're doing. They're not, you don't like the way that they're using the powers delegated to them. You don't like the fact that they're not using the powers delegated to them when you think they should, etc. But Jefferson continued, where powers are assumed which have not been delegated, so as soon as they go beyond the line of the Constitution, a nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. Not just a good idea to try later on, not just something to try after you try to get a bunch of protests organized and hope that the federal government, the government people will stop doing the things they weren't supposed to do in the first place. They'll start listening to you. Not in a few years after some court cases or some changing of the guard, whatever that may be. But as soon as they assume powers which have not been delegated, a nullification is the rightful remedy. He continued, every state has a natural right, in cases not within the compact, to nullify of their own authority. They don't have to wait for any other people of other states. They can nullify of their own authority all assumptions of power by others within their limits. Because even if everybody else thinks it's okay, but the people of your state think that they shouldn't be doing it, or maybe everybody else is afraid to take them on, and you guys have the courage, well, that's how you're supposed to deal with it. You don't need to rely. If you're living free, you don't need to rely on the approval of people, some other people, to actually be a free person. As Jefferson put it, a free people claim their rights as derived from the laws of nature and not as a gift of their chief magistrate. We'll come to that later in the episode as well. So everyone has a natural right to nullify of their own authority, that without this right, they would be under the dominion, absolute and unlimited, of whosoever might exercise this right of judgment for them. That's Thomas Jefferson in 1798. Now, in the middle end of the spectrum, and John Dickinson was known as the penman of the Revolution. He wrote a lot of stuff with Thomas Jefferson over the years. Well, maybe not a lot of stuff, but one of the most important one was the Declaration of Causes for why they were taking up arms on July 6, 1775. Now, here's Dickinson, who we could call the father of the Articles of Confederation. A few years later, he decided to support the Constitution, writing as Fabius in his fourth letter in 1788. He asked the question, it must be granted that a bad administration may take place. What is then to be done? So we can put together the best constitution possible. And he pointed out earlier in this essay that a good constitution promotes but doesn't always produce a good administration. So you can have a great constitution. Everything can be perfect. Everything can be clearly defined. And even then, you don't always get a good administration. Because if you're just relying on words on paper, sooner or later, people with power, just like Patrick Henry warned, if you rely on people to do the right thing, you're always going to lose liberty in the long run. So what is then to be done when there is a bad administration? And we only have bad administrations throughout all of our lives. Everyone alive today has only lived under a bad administration when it comes to the Constitution. The answer, Dickinson said, is instantly found before the supreme sovereignty of the people. In the American system, to the founders, to the old revolutionaries, sovereignty is final authority. This was a new type of a system where sovereignty was with the people of the several states, final authority, rather than with government, whether it was one government agent, one king, one queen, a cabal, an oligarchy, whatever it may be. The answer to what must be done is found before the supreme sovereignty of the people. And the answer is straightforward. It is their duty to watch and their right to take care that the Constitution be preserved, or in the Roman phrase, on perilous occasions, to provide that the Republic receive no damage. So it is the right and duty of the people to take care that their own Constitution is preserved, whether the government happens to agree with them or not, because the supreme sovereignty isn't with government, it's with the people of the several states. And then on the other end of the spectrum, let's go with the arch, well, the bad guy of the time, I guess, Alexander Hamilton. Here he is writing in Federalist Number 33 about the Supremacy Clause, talking about how, well, there's the supreme law of the land, and when they follow those things in the Constitution, the federal acts are supreme. But he says, it will not follow from this doctrine that acts of the large society, so the federal government, which are not pursuant, and he put it in all caps, which are not pursuant to its constitutional powers, but which are invasions on the residuary authorities of the smaller societies, the states, the people of the states, it will not follow, he said, that it will become the supreme law of the land. These will be merely acts of usurpation, and will deserve to be treated as such. So even Alexander Hamilton, the biggest big government guy of the time, he said, well, if they don't do the stuff that's not authorized to them. Now, of course, he changed what he considered was authorized over time, because he always wanted government to be bigger. I think this was part of his scam. But it's absolutely correct. When government does stuff that they're not supposed to do, this is a usurpation, a theft of power from the sovereign people of the several states, and those acts deserve to be treated that way. So how do you treat unconstitutional acts as unconstitutional acts? Roger Sherman gave us an answer in December of 1787. He said, though the general government in matters, he is also again talking about supremacy a little bit here, though the general government in matters within its jurisdiction is paramount to the constitutions and laws of the particular states. That's his version of supremacy clause, supreme law of the land. He said, yet all acts of the Congress not warranted by the Constitution would be void. These are acts of usurpation. And if the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, as soon as you go beyond it, those acts are usurpations and void in theory and in principle. But, he said, nor could they be enforced contrary to the sense of the majority of the states. And if you're not getting the hint there, if they deserve to be treated as a usurpation, if they deserve to be treated as void and they can't be enforced contrary to the sense of the people of a majority of the states, or the majority of the people of the states, however you want to word that, that means they're not participating in them. They are not complying with them. And just weeks later, James Madison published Federalist Number 46, where he gave us a four-step plan on how to respond to federal acts that you either A, don't like, think are bad policy, or B, think are unconstitutional. And you don't need the federal government to tell you that the federal government's acts are unconstitutional. That's what most people do today. Well, you can't say that's unconstitutional. Only the federal courts can do that. Nonsense. To Madison, it's up to the supreme, also the supreme sovereignty of the people. Everyone has to make a decision on this. And he said in Federalist 46, how do you deal with this? You don't do any of those first three things. He did not list any of those three things that I mentioned at the beginning of the episode on how to deal with the federal government, how to stop federal programs, how to defeat them without relying on the federal government to somehow magically limit its own power, which never happens. He said instead, and it was a focus on this, a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. And now I know a lot of people, when they're talking about 10th Amendment type stuff, nullification, states' rights, whatever you want to call it, people generally focus primarily on state governments. But to Madison here on Federalist 46, to all the other founders and old revolutionaries as well, this type of strategy goes beyond state governments because state governments still were an emanation of the final sovereignty, final authority, the power of the people in each state. Now, if I can find where my notes are supposed to be here, I gotta scroll this. I'm going to Madison's report of 1800, where he was actually trying to... I don't know. I don't have the notes handy, so I can't read the quote. But basically what he was trying to say is when we're talking about states, and he was describing the Virginia resolutions of 1798, passed a few weeks. It was finally passed on December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1798, after Jefferson's were passed that year. And he was basically talking about how, well, we're not just talking about states as governments. Certainly that's one of the ways. But there are multiple ways that we can use the term states in a general term, and you have to understand it in context. And the context that we're talking about here, a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union back in Federalist number 46, and then in Madison's report of 1800, you'll be able to command F or whatever and find the notes somewhere in here. This is a really long document. But basically he's saying we're also talking about the people of the several states, because ultimately each state, the final authority in each state are the people who live in those states. And I think that might be the most important for us to actually consider when you think about how to deal with the federal government. If Roger Sherman is telling us that a federal act outside the Constitution is void, and Alexander Hamilton says it's a usurpation, deserves to be treated as such, and if the state governments refuse to participate in it, let's say the feds pass a law from banning the people from owning some particular plant or a product or something like that, and then all 50 states ban enforcement of the federal act. And we know that the federal government relies heavily on the states to implement most federal programs. Almost every single federal act on the books has some kind of partnership between states and feds. And in many cases, when you're talking about actual enforcement actions, serving warrants and things like that, arrests and things like that, generally most of the grunt work is done by state and local law enforcement agencies and not the feds. The same thing happens on health regulations, environmental regulations, and it's not just the enforcement actions, it's the regulatory structure as well. That is oftentimes most of the work is done on the state level. The National Governors Association back in 2013, they told us during one of those fake shutdowns where they pretend it's a real shutdown, but the empire keeps rocking around the world and at home, they are telling us they were concerned about what was going to happen because, in their words, states are partners with the federal government on most federal programs. And the dirty little secret is partnerships don't work too well when half the team quits. So in our theoretical idea here, theoretical, I guess, if the federal government bans someone from owning a firearm or a plant, which they do, and all of the states, all 50 of them, ban enforcement of that federal act, if the people still comply with the feds, there is no nullification. There is no change. The federal act remains on the books. It remains fully enforced because no enforcement is needed. And that brings me back to John Dickinson again, the penman of the revolution. Oh, here's Madison's quote. I finally found it. I actually had two links open. He said, "It is indeed true that the term states is sometimes used in a vague sense and sometimes in different senses according to the subject to which it is applied. Thus, it sometimes means the separate sections of territory occupied by the political societies within each. Sometimes a particular government. So it could just be the landmass. It could be the state government established by the societies. And sometimes those societies as organized into the particular governments. And lastly, it means the people composing those political societies in their highest sovereign capacity." So the people, once again, sovereign final authority. So if we're focusing on the people and we recognize that when the states stop helping the federal government has a hard time, nearly impossible time enforcing their acts, it ultimately gets down to whether or not the people are willing to go along with the federal act or not. And that's exactly what John Dickinson told us in his great broadside against the Stamp Act. He said this is in late 1765, "If you comply with the act by using stamped papers, you fix You rivet perpetual chains upon your unhappy country. You unnecessarily, voluntarily establish the detestable precedent which those who have forged your fetters ardently wish for to varnish or prepare to build upon, to varnish the future exercise of this new claimed authority. So even if you think it wasn't, so he was basically taking the position that he understood that some people thought it was too big of an inconvenience to resist this. And it wasn't super inconvenient. It wasn't super expensive to deal with, to actually comply. So he was saying, that's not what we're concerned with. Because as soon as we comply with this, we've given them the precedent to expand on this. And recognizing the human nature, the maxim of human nature, that people with power will always see the power that they have as a floor, not a maxima, and they will always try to expand it. That's what Dickinson was warning against. As soon as you give them the power to do this, even if it's just a couple of pennies, they're going to build on this over time. And he continued, "The Stamp Act, therefore, is to be regarded only as an experiment of your disposition." And if you're watching the video, you can see some all caps there as well, just like Hamilton did in Federalist 33. The Stamp Act and any act that they're not authorized to do is an experiment of the disposition of the people. He said, if you quietly bend your necks to that yoke, you prove yourselves ready to receive any bondage to which your lords and masters shall please to subject you. So compliance establishes the detestable precedent. There is no nullification with compliance. There is no liberty with compliance. And that's what James Otis Jr. said some years earlier. This was a few years later. In 1767, writing as Freeborn American, he said, there is nothing, and this is a paraphrase, there is nothing that will destroy liberty, nothing, according to James Otis Jr., that will destroy liberty more than a prevailing opinion that it is better tamely to submit than nobly assert and vindicate our privileges. So as long as people continue to comply, then government has no reason to withdraw. Government will continue to expand, and if the compliance, it goes along with waiting on government to tell us when the government itself violated the rules given to it by the people to the government, then we have a much worse problem, and that's the problem we're facing today. Here's James Otis again in 1762. He said, so long as people will submit to arbitrary measures, so long they will find masters. Arbitrary measures are those that are, well, it's just up to the whim of the people in power. Arbitrary power was one of the grievances in the Declaration of Independence. So as long as people submit to those measures that they're not authorized to do, they're just doing because they're capable of it, they will continue to find masters. This mentality of the people having to refuse to comply, to resist, was brought forward during the ratification debates. It's the same type of message that we got from Hamilton. Here's James Iredell in the North Carolina ratifying convention. If you've never heard his name, don't be surprised. Government schools don't teach about most anything that's worthwhile. They just give you dates and battles and stuff like that. And they tell you that all the solutions to the problems that are caused by government are to go to government and get more government. But here's what James Iredell, who ended up being one of the first associate justices on the Supreme Court, nominated by George Washington, he told us that the people will resist if the government usurp powers not delegated to it. Well, of course, he was looking at the people of the time, and that actually played out pretty true in the following few years. But he said, look, this is how you keep them in check. We have to recognize, just like Dickinson was saying, we have to recognize that in any situation, you're going to find a government that goes beyond its limits. Doesn't matter how good of people you think we are. Doesn't matter how good of a document you think we've put together. Eventually, government just does what government does. But how do you keep them in check? The people have to resist if government usurps powers not delegated to it. Theophilus Parsons put it this way in the Massachusetts Ratifying Convention. He's one of the guys who helped make the deal with Samuel Adams and John Hancock to actually get ratification in Massachusetts, along with a recommendation for what became the 10th Amendment. Pretty important dude. He was kind of there, well, nah, side story. Anyways, he said, an act of usurpation, so an act outside the Constitution, is a theft of power from the sovereign people of the several states. That's usurpation. He says, an act of usurpation is not obligatory. It is not law, and any man may be justified in his resistance. And like I mentioned a little earlier, this is the Jeffersonian view, and you can't go wrong with this one. A free people claim their rights as derived from the laws of nature and not as the gift of their chief magistrate. So as long as you wait for government to tell you that government, shouldn't be doing the stuff that government's been doing, you are not a free people. As long as you do things that require government permission slips, government approval, that is not a free people. That, again, is a population on its knees begging for permission. And this is absolutely essential to get this kind of information out there to more and more people, because we need strength in numbers. And nothing helps us reach and teach more people every single day more than the financial faith and support of our members. You can join us over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members for as little as $2 a month. We also do some annual, lifetime, five-year options. But if you like a monthly one and you got a couple of bucks of that dirty government fiat you want to throw out there somewhere, we're happy to take it. No one does more with less to stand for the Constitution and liberty than here at the TAC. And I do want to say a huge thank you to just a handful of people who have joined us as members lately. Thank you goes out to William in Maryland, Jill in New Mexico, Ezra in Virginia, Daniel here in California, Anastasia in the Free State of New Hampshire, and I don't know if anyone's really the Free State, but they've got a pretty cool slogan, Raymond in North Carolina. Thank you so much. Again, if you want to join them, it's 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. I want to take over a look over in the live chat and see if there's any comments or questions and see if there's anything I can get back to quickly. Kirk Morrison points out that we do need to force our state to quit helping the feds. Certainly. And there are so many areas where that needs to be done. We cover this in our most recent State of the Nullification Movement report over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/report. It's a 232-page free book that you can download and read. The first half of it goes into much greater detail. Well, it's not even half, but the first section of it goes into much greater detail on this strategy. I am barely scratching the surface here. More detail on the strategy of how to beat the federal government when the federal government refuses to follow the rules, again, which is constantly and without waiting on the federal government to do the right thing, because we can't rely on that. We could wait for generations before they ever decide, like, oh, okay, let's do the right thing. And I can't even see a path to where that's actually ever going to happen, at least on its own. It's going to take resistance, as the founders and old revolutionaries told us. So at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/report, we cover that strategy, the philosophy, the theory, but the bigger section in the maybe the last half to two-thirds of it covers how this strategy is being used today, right now, before our very eyes, on the right to keep and bear arms, on prohibition on plants, on surveillance, on civil asset forfeiture, and a lot more. It's, again, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/report. And this is the time of year we call nullification season, because this is the time of year when most state legislatures are in session. So if we're working, like Kirk is saying, to get our states to stop participating, to make it a little less difficult for the people to defy the federal acts, because if the states don't do the enforcement, it becomes much more difficult for the feds to do anything about it. This is the time of year that that happens. And we've got a new Friday show platform, or what do you call it? Format on Friday show, nullification movement news. I'll get some updates on Friday's show in a short episode soon as well. So I appreciate that comment, Kirk, and good to see you back. Hope you're doing well. Happy Snowfish. It's talking about John Marshall. I should do some episodes on John Marshall. Certainly wasn't, I'm not a big fan, but a lot of things that we think we know about John Marshall and the things that he was saying have been twisted in support of more and more big government today, when even John Marshall wasn't on board with some of that stuff. And that's why I like to sometimes cite his great buddy Alexander Hamilton as well, because, well, we know that Marshall took the version of necessary and proper, where necessary doesn't mean necessary, it just means convenient to the power of people in power and government. That came right from Alexander Hamilton. So these are not the good guys when it comes to the Constitution and liberty. But when even they sound like small government people from time to time in comparison to what we have today, that should tell us quite a bit. Let's see what else. We've got a spammer over on Twitch, but thank you for being here. Jeffrey Heilman, I apologize. Harrelman. I'm not sure if I say the last name right, but hi, Jeffrey. Appreciate you being here. Time that we take back control. The people have the power. It's just that they need to use it. Now, St. George Tucker pointed out that just because the people have acquiesced for a long time, either because, well, they didn't love liberty, or they were afraid or incapable or overwhelmed or whatever it may be, just because they've acquiesced in usurpations for a long time does not mean that they still don't have the sovereign power to resume their own power, to take control whenever they see fit or are capable of doing so. And so that's an important message in the face of the largest government in history that I know can be very overwhelming, but it is something that we have to certainly work for. Samuel Adams told us that all might be free if they, A, valued freedom and defended it as they ought. So we need a two-pronged campaign of educating people on the values of freedom, on the role of government under the Constitution, where they're going too far, etc., and then how to defend it. And this episode here is focused primarily on how to defend things. Anyways, I really appreciate you guys being here. I hope you enjoyed the episode. More important than anything, I hope you learned something. I hope it made you think. Of course, don't forget that membership program, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. I'll get the blog post published for this as soon as I can over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/path to liberty. I appreciate you being here. I hope you have an awesome day. And I'll see you on Friday here on the Path to Liberty.